In order to give you a flesh and blood example of what this type of thing does, we specifically correlated our evidence so that some people would be before you, such as Ernie Hartwell. Well, I heard Mr. Johnson say, well, what does Las Vegas, Nevada have to do with Clearwater, Florida? Well, I think it's quite apparent if they are making $500,000 a week during one period, or $1 million a week during another period, or $2.3 million at least once, here for auditing, based on slave labor, which is what we'll get into at a later point in time, then, and they're using it in the way that I suggested, if you can see a flesh and blood example of that, then you'll begin to realize that you're dealing with human beings and not just pieces of paper. As the one exhibit on this issue we put on the transparency showed, I mean, Ernie Hartwell is someone who was told that he was going to come to Clearwater, Florida, and he ended up in the desert giving them auditing information, and when he realized how significantly he had been duped, and he tried to fight back to the degree that Ernie Hartwell could fight back, you saw what happened. You heard from him what happened to him. You heard from Janie Peterson as an operative, and she was only, I suggest to you, in GOPR, Sergeant's Office of Public Relations, which is probably the most neuter branch of the Guardian's office. That's like Mr. Will here. I mean, those are the people who go out and show the public what nice guys we are. I mean, the Guardian's office, B1, in intelligence gathering divisions, but because of the high degree of compartmentalization, one generally has no idea what the other's got. They are just told to go do this and go do that with it. But you heard Janie Peterson testify how not only in the case of the Hartwells, she went out and used that information, or the organization, not Janie Peterson, the organization went out and used that information. Took it to the Las Vegas Review Journal, issued a press release saying that he was a murderer, which is another whole issue, which we don't have the time for. Take his conversations, edited the conversations, and then tried to use those against him. Took Tanya Burden's auditing files, which were, according to her affidavit, as you will see, for 2 years and some 3 or 4 months, taken here in Clearwater, Florida, while she coded and decoded telexes as a 15-year-old child for the GO, and put on L. Ron Hubbard's pants, as her affidavit shows, and took off his pants and put his shirt on and walked around collecting his ashes, as her affidavit shows. And in the interim, when she wasn't doing that, she was coding and decoding telexes for a criminal conspiracy, only they were double and triple coded, so she didn't even know what they were. And how their coding process works is another whole issue. And one of our exhibits is the correct use of codes. But they took Tanya Burden's auditing information and telexed it from Clearwater, Florida, and sent it out to the GO in Las Vegas, and the GO, as Ms. Peterson testified, used it out there, and also Lavinda Van Schaik. Well, with regard to the Hartwells and Van Schaik, those people appeared before you. They told you what they did. Then you saw them, and you saw the GO operative and what the GO operative did with it. That's a real example, totally correlated, of how the information is used. But I would suggest to you that that example should not just be from, as an investigative body, one of your responsibilities, together with all of the other information and evidence before you, would be to infer from that how widespread it is based on the policies, one of which was introduced into evidence by Mary Sue Hubbard, to use the information. And I think you may recall the policy says to use all ethics personal processing files. So that is just one example. And a very significant point. Very significant. Mr. McKee testified that up in Connecticut, per policy, he sent the files, the flags, and he didn't know what they were doing with them. And if he'd known, he wouldn't have spent 24 years in the organization, or paid whatever amount, I don't believe he testified how much he paid, I happen to know, but whatever he did pay, assuming he did, or would just draw the inference from what other people paid. So some 19-year-old child in Clearwater whose auditing files, if he began in Los Angeles like David Ray, who didn't get that much auditing, fortunately, but I would suggest to you that perhaps Casey Kelly coming from Oregon, or Linda Van Schaik coming from Las Vegas, the flag, and all of those auditing files being sent from Las Vegas to flag when she came here, and now in the possession of this organization here, and used in the way they were used against Van Schaik, all of those issues demonstrate what's being done with those that auditing information.
Sorry, and then, please. Did Mr. Day say he stopped sending those from Connecticut?
I believe he says now that he has stopped sending them for a long period of time. He testified that he did, but he now doesn't. He is now, as he testified, disassociated from the organization, so he wouldn't be sending anything to them now. But for I believe he specifically testified for many years that he did, but he stopped now. And I think he did say that he'd burn them now before he would send them, now that he knows what he knows, which is, of course, the whole fundamental issue of deception, which is the fundamental issue underlying the two ordinances that we have proposed dealing with consumer fraud, charitable solicitation of funds. And on that point, as our very minimal case study shows, or preliminary case study shows, the Supreme Court has constantly said over and over again, and they just said in connection with this Minnesota case involving Unification Church, in this case in New Mexico. And the cases are set forth in our preliminary report, particularly the Schomburg case. The Supreme Court has said over and over again, when you're dealing with charitable solicitation of funds in purported religious organizations on their face, you can't, if the organization makes 100 misrepresentations, or makes 100 representations of which 10 are false and 90 are accurate, you can't completely shut down all of their solicitation. It's too broad. You can't simply vest in a public official the right to not grant the permit to solicit. Cantwell v. Connecticut, in every case since, has repeatedly stated you deal with the fraud. You don't ban the entire solicitation practice or their right to solicit until after an adjudication, and you deal with the fraud. If the fraud permeates the entire solicitation practice after an adjudication, well, then that's what you'd be dealing with. So we have drafted our ordinance to comply with the Supreme Court cases to deal with the fraud, not to simply vest in a public official the right to deny a permit, which is what every other Supreme Court case, when they have struck down ordinances of that type, have done. And the League of Mercy case in Jacksonville, when they enacted an ordinance, I submit to you, has been upheld by the Florida courts. And yet, in our professional judgment, that particular ordinance is also unconstitutional. But an ordinance, as Cantwell v. Connecticut says, and Schomburg says, every case virtually says, deal with fraud. Don't ban completely the practice by simply allowing a public official to say, no, you can't do anything. Deal with what is fraudulent. With regard to some of the issues, the legal issues that deal with the confidentiality of auditing information, in terms of criminal activity, it permeates extortion, blackmail. In terms of some civil responsibilities, it permeates issues concerning invasion of privacy, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of contract, fraud, misrepresentation, all of those issues. Most of those things can be dealt with in a consumer protection statute. If there's a consumer protection ordinance that specifically says you can't do it, you can't tell someone that it's going to be held in confidence, and then not hold it in confidence. And then if the person does it, and you have a lawsuit against them, and an adjudication punishable by a $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 fine, whatever is warranted based on the degree of harm or the degree of wrong, then every time it's done, that penalty is imposed. And that's a very simple thing to regulate. Then arises the issue of some type of injunction. If they do it for in any pattern per policy, then you can prevent it possibly altogether if there's strong enough evidence. Or you can post perhaps a placard right behind the registration desk, just like a warning on a cigarette package, just like the warning in the article or device case, that the organization is a practice of doing it, and every time they do it, fine is levied. Or everyone who walks in that door sees in large capital letters, this organization from such and such to such and such has done the following with your auditing information, or perhaps in a more legalistic manner. And as our ordinance suggests, all of this would not be simply vested in a public official to go do it, which would probably be unconstitutional, although in some instances it may not be, depending on various standards that could be used, but it could easily follow an adjudication. And if the issue was compelling enough to the community, as I suggest, this issue is compelling enough, perhaps it could be treated expeditiously in the legal process, so that some corrective measures and remedial processes can be invoked. I would suggest to you that if that type of deception, along with the other types of deception we've talked about, is one of the ways they make money, it may have some impact. With regard to the evidence on this issue, I've already gone over a little bit of it. There's a lot of it in the exhibits. There's been a number of witnesses, all of whom have testified that if they'd known, they wouldn't have given the information or that they wouldn't have paid the money. There's substantial evidence for, and we intended it to be so on that issue for that reason. But even Mr. DeWolf testified, if you wanted to believe him, that as far back as 1954, his father was bugging the auditing room. In terms of pattern, that pattern, I would suggest to you, has been taking place from 1954 right up to at least Jane Peterson's testimony. And maybe, right up to today, if David Ray's information came from where I, at least I would suggest it came from.
Can we have Mr. Ray back to give sworn testimony as to the information he put in the auditing file, since he is not aware of him? We take deposition in
the
West Coast to find out if Mr. Ray, in fact, indeed, gave this information. That would show the pattern, if one exists, up to the present day today, May 1982. I'd like to request the commission take the steps to have Mr. Ray's deposition concerning this issue.
I would suggest to you that that level of persistency is what will cure the problem.
Mr. Flynn, you mentioned about the auditing and the if the evidence and transcript and record shows that indeed there's a pattern or need for some kind of consumer protection. How do we, after hearing the testimony, how can we ascertain whether or not the auditing or confidentiality is being broken on a regular day-to-day basis?
I would suggest to you that the more openness that is injected into this entire operation, the more people are made aware that there is someone to go to, the more they're made aware of the fact that things are not as clandestine and secret as they're led to believe, the more that the truth can penetrate, on whatever way it can penetrate. Maybe it would start with a Paulette Cooper. Then maybe it would go to a Lavenda Van Schaik or a Nan McLean, and then to Janie Petersons, who in my opinion was one of the most courageous witnesses, for reasons known to me, to appear before you.
Janie Peterson. Commissioners, you have just a limited amount of time to speak, sir, and I would rather prefer that we allow you the time, and if we still have questions of you, we can ask it of you if your concluding remarks when the time is ours.
Thank you, Mayor. But I would suggest to you that more Scott Mayers that he suggested to you. And on that point, Scott Mayer, when he testified, dragged out some... Scott Mayer is a very thinking person, I would suggest, and he dragged out some outlines of things that he thought you should do, and Mr. Burfield asked him whether he had discussed it with us in advance. Well, I tell you, and I would go under oath, that I had no discussion with Mr. Mayer in advance about his particular outline, but I was happy to see that he had thought through some of those things and presented them to you. But there may be, if more truth is injected into this situation, which for at least 7 years in this city has basically been a matter of media attention, if more truth was injected by whatever manner, in whatever way, into the situation, there'd be more Scott Mayers and more Janie Petersons and Tanya Burdens and Lavinda Van Schaik who have the courage to come forward. So in response to Mr. Caldefanks, you may get kids more willing to walk across the street in a little less state of fear. Or maybe if there was a little less state of fear, they wouldn't even be there. And if there was a notice behind the regging desk or the cramming room that those legal options existed, a notice posted by this city, maybe they'd begin at least to look at it and think about it. And the regger or the crammer may say, that's just a legal problem. He may think a little more, just a little. And that one little thought at some point may induce him to come forward. Now, we're on our third area. There's, I think, 12. We'll have to move quickly. With regard to deception of the overall nature, purposes, organizational structure, what the organization is, what is Scientology to someone who is first presented with it? There are just unending issues. There are issues concerning primarily, I would suggest, the fair game doctrine. Well, they say they canceled it. You saw the cancellation. This policy letter is this. What we're not going to do anymore is we're not going to put on ethics orders that the fair game policy exists. That's what it said. We're not going to put it on ethics orders. In other words, we're not going to put it in writing. It causes bad public relations. This policy does not cancel any treatment of an SP. That's what it says. And I suggest the Church of Scientology come in here right now with their version of the cancellation. And I suggest to you that some of the exhibits we put in, such as Exhibit 4, was a fair game declaration with the policy date in it. And the policy date is 1965, and the second one, there's a long fair game policy and a short one. They both integrate with one another. They're exhibits 1 and 2, as you'll see. The cancellation is in 1968, 2 years after those two were adopted. The fair game declare that we put into evidence is dated 8 June 1979, referring to the policy in 1965. I suggest to you that any common sense interpretation would tell you that it hasn't been canceled. Then you get into the issue of conduct. And those are the pieces of paper, their own pieces of paper. Then you get into the question of conduct and the inferences to be drawn from conduct. The inferences to be drawn from Operation Snow White to penetrate every national agency across this country, which is one of the exhibits. And that took place in the 1970s. The cancellation was in 1968. Or Operation Normandy, or Operation Taco Left against your former mayor, or Operation Speedy Gonzales, or Keeler 1 or Keeler 2. Those took place in the 75, 76, 77 era. Merrill Veneer, pursuant to one of those operations, penetrated your former mayor's law firm in the 70s. Or what they did to Tanya Burden or Lavinda Van Schaik through the use of auditing information. I mean, the inferences to be drawn from what was done to them as late as 1980 in terms of lying, cheating, or destroying, there are very clear-cut legal inferences, as any trier of fact could find, from just the conduct alone. And the conduct is substantial. Right up to David, Mr. Johnson appearing in this room here today with David Ray's information, if you decided to draw that inference. Most witnesses, I believe, testified that they wouldn't have joined the organization if they knew the criminal operations were taking place. So whether Fair Game is canceled or not canceled, there's no question that these criminal operations, I mean, 11 people have been convicted and, they're in, and 10 of whom are in jail. And the 11th, I'm sure, it'll be quite immediate where she will go to jail. Every witness, I believe, testified, or almost every witness, that they would not have joined the organization, paid money, provided labor, did whatever they did, moved beds for 16 to 18 hours a day, took invoices like Casey Kelly did, whatever services were provided or monies paid, they wouldn't have done it if they'd known that this organization was breaking into or into places pursuant to their operations on how to break in, or burglar, or infiltrating the Clearwater Sun, or conducting all these hundreds of other operations that have been put before you. They wouldn't have done that if they know the organization had a policy to do such things. And I believe specifically McKee of 24 years gave some evidence on, at least inferentially on that issue, Kelly of 3 years and Ray of 6 months. That covers a long time span. If they knew that those criminal operations were taking place, they wouldn't have joined that organization. That in itself is an organizational deception. What the GO does, what it has done, what it continues to do, the written policies it's got to do it, is all organizational deception. With regard to just some of the peripheral links to Clearwater, you've got all of the operations in Clearwater, which we haven't even discussed. Then you've got Project Owl, which came from Clearwater, originated by Mitchell Herman. And you've got Burton's auditing files going out from Clearwater to Las Vegas, the Hartwell enticement to come to Clearwater. All of those are types of deception, which had they known about the nature of the organization, its goals, purposes, etc., they wouldn't have pursued. Some of the financial issues involving it's a crime to give anything away, make money, make more money, the price list, that Kelly testimony that nothing was given away. All of those would suggest to you that there is not a charitable purpose here. You can't give, for instance, auditing, which is alleged to be for spiritual travail, to a terminally ill person, if you remember the testimony of Laurie Taverna. I mean, that would give you some inferential suggestion as to the charitable purposes of this organization, or whether it's just to acquire money. And what it does with its money, if Casey Kelly thought that the money was being used to infiltrate the city commission's office, as opposed to all the things that he thought it was being used for, there's a level of deception that has been practiced right there, which this commission can consider. There's a level of charitable purposes right there that this commission can consider. And those types of things go all the way down the evidentiary chain. One specific example is Mr. Kelly couldn't get a typewriter. But Mr. Mayor could travel to Hawaii and accuse some poor victim of bestiality in order to get her to raise the income. Or Janie Peterson couldn't get paper, but Gary Klingler could be sent to Boston to tell Lavenda Van Schaik that her husband was having an affair, that her lawyer was going to be disbarred. I would suggest to you that all of that evidence would show you what the priority of the use of funds was in deciding whether the priority related to charitable purposes or other purposes. And the legal significance on a potential charitable solicitation of funds ordinance is broad-ranging and will be discussed in whatever follow-up report we present. And then you have issues concerning the use of telexes, the evidence of crimes already before the commission, both documentary and testimonial, involve extortion, blackmail, larceny, burglary, bugging, obstruction of justice, conspiracy, smuggling, false swearing, perjury, violation of IRS laws and immigration and customs laws of the state of Kyoto. Civil torts involve fraud, breach of contract, invasion of privacy, emotional distress, breach of fiduciary duty, and potentially the minimum wage laws of the state of Kyoto. The article or device warning has already been discussed to some degree. It's a fundamental issue in the case. It has very specific legal significance. I won't go into it in any more length at present time. I think every witness testified that if they had known that there was no scientific basis for this thing, they wouldn't have become involved, basically. And the article or device warning, which is in evidence specifically, requires them in 11-point leaded type to do that, which in some publications they do. In some publications they do something narrower, but in no publication that I have ever read have they ever done it in full compliance with the court order. And in this particular publication, what is Scientology?
Mr. Flynn, I might point out that within the last year or 2 years, a personalized copy of that was given to each one of the city commissioners, to myself, as well as Mr. Buston, the attorney.
I know, they were directly to
it. Was before, it may have been before you
came on. That was my gift when I became mayor.
A couple of years ago, they...
I believe the warning says on the cover page or the title page. Well, the cover is the cover, and the title page is there. That's the title page. And you can ask people that are familiar with publications. I used to be the editor-in-chief of a law review, so I know a little bit about publications. But you can ask perhaps the reporters what the title, the cover page and the title page is. And then you turn to this page, and you see the size of the print. And stuck in here, and I think you can see the size of it, is the E-meter is not intended or effective for the diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. Well, that is probably one-third, number one, of what the warning said you should put in. And I won't dig out the warning now, but it's a number of sentences and it goes on in detail. That's a very shortened down version. It's not an 11-point leaded type. It's not where it's supposed to be. And I suggest to you that the level of deception perpetrated by this organization in placing it where it placed it, on this particular page where they give the printing dates.
Not too many of us read those.
It's something that inferentially you can consider. The legal documents issue is an issue that we could talk for 2 hours on. There's evidence, we put them in on releases, waivers, freeloaders, debts, things like that. Kelly testified that he thought that he would only have to pay the freeloader's debt if he tried to get back in. Well, even that has some legal significance. Ray testified that he was told he had a $6,000 freeloader's debt. As the exhibits will show, Tanya Burden, after December 17, 1977, when she was made to sign these disclosures, releases, and everything else she signed, was sent a freeloader's debt. She was out of the organization. She was not trying to get back in the organization. She was out, and she was told that she paid it. And I suggest to you that if these hearings, if this commission investigated it further and brought in many witnesses on this particular issue, you'll see affidavits on the issue that we've submitted, and you'll see other documents that have been signed that have been introduced as exhibits along this point. But you will find, I would submit to you, that 90% of people getting out of Scientology who have been staff members and received services believe that they owe that debt. So that alone is a legal issue that has serious consequences in a consumer protection ordinance. The Kelly's marriage license, although a small item, is of some significance because it relates to the disconnect policy and the attitude, and you've seen the disconnect policy and the overhead transparency, that you must divorce someone who is PTS to you, someone who is against Scientology. Well, they have a legal obligation, if they marry people as ministers, which they hold themselves out to be, to file in the clerk of this city, I would suppose, I'm not county. Precisely familiar,
county clerk,
with the county, that the marriage has taken place. Well, in Kelly's situation, it didn't. Well, that was one witness out of 15. Now, how many people do we know who've been married or not married? I don't know. Maybe many more witnesses would have a similar experience. There was some testimony that there are many quickie marriages in the church. And the legal significance to the county or the city on that issue alone is important. And it also demonstrates to some degree the effectiveness of the disconnect policy, which is a whole issue in itself. There is the whole issue upon which no evidence has been submitted on organizations like ASI, Applied Scholastics, Narconon, the Elderly Society, JARIS, et cetera, et cetera, their purposes and what they do. But intertwined with all that is the question of if these women are having children and are married or not married, the legal consequences to the children. There are issues pertaining to whether or not who's supporting the children, who's legally responsible to support the child, whether they go on the welfare rolls. In the city of Boston, because of our own particular investigatory efforts about how the staff lived in the city of Boston, we have determined for many former staff members how they live in terms of food stamps, welfare, unemployment, and things like that. That issue hasn't even been addressed in these proceedings. And the potential consequences to children, or there's a particular welfare program for dealing with children. Things like that permeate all of these legal considerations with regard to the way the church treats the walk world and the legal requirements of the walk world. And then, for instance, to perpetrate the level of deception that I would submit the evidence shows on an individual such as David Ray and make him sign a release and further perpetrate the deception that the release is binding, so he's afraid of going to a lawyer, or doesn't even think of going to it because he thinks he signed a release. I mean, this is a 19-year-old boy you're talking about. Most of those kids, they wouldn't even know how to go to a lawyer. And they think they've already signed a document for all their rights are lost anyway. And we're not talking about a document that gives them the right to get in heaven or hell. We're talking about a right to bring a lawsuit pursuant potentially to a consumer protection ordinance over here in the Pinellas County Courthouse to get their money back.